Good afternoon, everybody. First, I don't have any relationships to disclose. So my name is Charlie Ransford. I'm Director of Science and Policy at Cure Violence, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the Cure Violence approach and the theories behind it. At Cure Violence, what we really try to do is take a scientific approach to gun violence. And what I mean by this is we try to understand scientifically what is causing people to behave violently. Why are they adopting this behavior? And then design an approach around that to try to prevent it. And so when we look at the science, the thing that we really find is that violence is a contagious process. So in other words, it works like a contagious disease where people are adopting this behavior because they're learning it from other people around them. And there's abundance of evidence for this. And here's just a few examples. So what we find with child abuse, one type of violence, is that approximately 30% of child abuse victims go on to become child abusers, something that doesn't really make sense unless a behavior is being transmitted. We see that countries that go to war oftentimes have increases in homicide, and there's also studies showing that people that go to war sometimes come home more aggressive, adopting violent behaviors. And what we also see is that in violent communities, we have people that are, this is a study of one public housing complex, you know, where everyone is experiencing poverty and everyone's experiencing disadvantage. But the people that are exposed to violence chronically early in their life, later on in their life, they have a 30 times increase in risk of perpetrating violent crime. So the real difference between who's exhibiting this violent behavior and who's not really is who's exposed to the violent behavior. And this particular study really showed a dose-response relationship, so that those with the very highest exposure had the very highest risk, and those with intermediate exposure had intermediate risk, and those with low exposure had basically low to no risk of behaving violently. And, you know, I've been showing research from about, you know, child abuse to child abuse and community violence to community violence, but really what the research shows us is that there's a relationship across syndromes. So, for instance, if you're a victim of child abuse, you have an increased risk of not only perpetrating child abuse, you also have an increased risk of perpetrating violence in the community and perpetrating violence to your spouse. And the same thing works with exposure to community violence. It's not just about increased risk in the community. It's also increased risk of being violent at your home. So it's really about exposure to violence itself, increasing a risk of behaving violently. And the type of violence is really about context and environment, and less about the relationship of that type of violence itself. So what do we understand about the means of transmission? How is it that people are picking this up through exposure? And so what we really see is violence really is transmitted visually largely, and it's really about observing it and seeing it and experiencing it, and that having an effect on a very specific part of the body. It has an effect on your brain, an organ of the body. And just like with other diseases, not everybody exposed becomes violent. There are a lot of modulating factors. Age tends to matter quite a bit, as does type of exposure and the dose, the level of violence that you've been exposed to. And what we see is this really works in much the same way as diseases work. And you have very much the same types of modulating factors. Not everybody exposed to stomach flu is going to get it. It really has a lot to do with your age, has a lot to do with the dose. And so we see violence operating in much the same way that epidemic diseases do. So the ways in which it affects the brain, there are really several ways in which it affects the brain. But one of the big ones is social learning. And so it's basically modeling. And so a person exposed to a behavior picks up that behavior, unconsciously starts to learn it and model it. And this happens with all types of behavior, but it really is really particularly acute with violence because violence is such a traumatic event that it really has quite a large impact on a person's brain. And so, I mean, one of the things I think we have to realize, you might be thinking, you know, I've been exposed to violence, but I don't behave violently, even though I've been exposed. So I think what we have to realize is that we are talking about different doses here. We're really talking about different levels of violence exposure. So people in really chronically violent communities, they're dealing with violence all the time. They see violence in their community and severe violence, shootings, homicides. They see violence in their schools, on the school bus. They see violence right outside their home and inside their home. So it's a different level of dose. And so why are people behaving violently? Because they're continually being exposed to it and continually seeing this, and then they start to unconsciously model this behavior. A second factor that turns out to be really important as well are the social norms of a community. And what we find is that people are behaving violently a lot of times because that's what they think their friends expect them to do. That if somebody disrespects you, that you should behave violently towards that person. It's a social expectation. And then there's a third way in which violence really affects people, and that is through a traumatic experience and the effects it has on your brain. And what a lot of people that have this type of exposure, what happens is you have a desensitization to violence, or sometimes you can become hyper-aroused. And so what's happening really is sort of a survival mechanism that the brain is adjusting. You have a constant exposure to violence, and all of a sudden your brain starts to adapt, and any little cue can set you off because you have been conditioned to start to behave that way and respond to cues in a certain way. So these are just some examples of the way it affects the brain and the way that violence exposure works. There's really a lot more detail to this. There's a report that was put out by the Institute of Medicine called The Contagion of Violence, and it's available for free download on their website, iom.org. And I encourage you to look. They really have a lot of the most recent findings in how violence is transmitted. So because we understand that violence is transmitted, that it's a contagious process, what this means is that we can treat it just like we treat epidemic diseases. It operates like an epidemic disease, so we treat it like one. And the way in which we treat epidemic diseases, there's really just three parts. First, you interrupt the transmission of that disease. Then you prevent future spread of the disease. And then you change the norms that encourage the spread of that disease. And so what we've done in Cure Violence is we've taken this World Health Organization model designed for epidemic diseases, and we've adapted it to deal with violence as a disease. So I'll go over each of these components just to explain a little bit more about how the model works. So in terms of interrupting transmission, what this means is it's transmitted because people are exposed to a violent act. And so to stop that transmission, we have to take conflicts that are brewing in a community that could become violent and stop them before they could become violent. And the way in which we do this is by hiring people that are from the community who have ties to people that are violent to go out in that community and find out about what kind of conflicts are going on and then mediate those conflicts before they become violent. One of the key ways in which we do this is by working in hospitals specifically. And so when we work in a hospital, what we're doing is one of the biggest predictors of a shooting is a prior shooting, because what you have is a retaliation for that prior event. And so by working in a hospital, we're able to respond not only to that victim, but to the people in the waiting room who are talking about getting back at that person. And we work to mediate those conflicts to prevent that retaliation. And this ends up being a really important part of the work that we do. The second aspect of it, preventing future spread. What this is about is it's about identifying who are the people that are most likely to behave violently and then working with them to change their behaviors. And again, what this is about working with workers who are from the community, who have trust and are able to work with that person one-on-one over the course of months and a year to really decrease their risk so that they are no longer people that are going to spread violence as a behavior. And then the third way is about changing norms. And so really what this is about giving people in the community a voice to express different types of norms, positive norms, so that the message gets across that you are not expected to behave violently. Actually, you're expected to not behave violently. So it's providing a different message than the people in the community are hearing from their peers and giving them basically an out so that they don't have to behave violently. And as I've said, alluded to a little bit, one of the key aspects of this work is really working with credible messengers. So when we hire people to do the work of interrupting violence, of working as outreach workers, we're hiring people from the community. We're hiring people that might have criminal backgrounds, that might have been involved in gang violence. But the key is they have the social relationships, they have the network, and they're trusted. Because they're trusted and credible, they have access. And the only way you're going to change the way people behave, the only way you're going to be able to mediate a conflict, is if you have that trust and access. So that's why we hire these types of credible messengers. And as you can see, I have several different places here, and wherever we work, we're hiring workers that are going to be trusted by that individual. And so we can adapt it to a cultural context by working with people in that environment. There's been several independent evaluations of this work. The first one was done in Chicago by Wesley Scogan and his team. They looked at seven different communities. And the range of drops in shootings and killings were 41% to 73%, of which they found that approximately 16% to 28% was specifically responsible because of the Cure Violence program. In Baltimore, the study that Dr. Webster did, he found, as he said, They looked at the three program sites that were on model. They found statistically significant reductions in violence in each of those. And one community had a drop in killings, statistically significant, of 56%. And then the New York City evaluation found that shootings were 20% lower than what the models predicted they would be based on the trends in the surrounding areas. The program is also spreading around the country. It's something that's, I think, an idea that's picking up steam, that you can have this sort of health approach to violence that can be effective. We have programs in approximately 20 cities around the country in 50 different sites. And internationally, we're starting to spread as well. You can see several programs we have around the world, specifically in Latin America and to a lesser extent in the Middle East as well. If you want to learn more about how this program works, there's a great documentary that was done on our work. What they do is they follow around several of our violence interrupters, and they show you what their work looks like on a day-to-day basis. And you can really see what the program looks like. So I've been talking specifically about Cure Violence, but Cure Violence is a health approach to violence, and we're only one health approach to violence. There's now several health approaches to violence out there, and I think what we see is health really taking much more of a role in violence prevention, that there's a specific role that health professionals can do that other people can't do. And it's not that health is the solution to violence, but it's an important piece to violence that currently many communities are not utilizing. And so public health, I think, can bring a lot to violence prevention about defining this problem on health terms, about identifying the risk and protective factors so we can be more effective in who we reach, and about developing and testing and adopting effective strategies. But there are also a lot of very specific roles that people should be taking to elevate this issue for the health community. So city and county and state health departments really should be taking on this issue. They can implement health approaches to violence. And a lot of our programs that we work with are, in fact, implemented by health departments because they're really a key player. But they can also take on the responsibility reporting data on violence because they are an important player in this process. Hospitals should be implementing programs to treat people, the mental health of people who are exposed to violence. Treating a gun injury just by patching somebody up is not enough anymore because we know the effects it has on people's mental health. And so what we really need to do is do more in regards to that. Doctors, nurses, and other health professionals should be doing more to help us identify and screen who is exposed to violence, who needs this type of treatment. And then universities and schools of public health really should be doing a lot more as well to take on this issue to help us implement more effective solutions. And communities should be expecting that it's not just a police response, but the health community also needs to respond. Here are a few resources. If people want to find out what they can do, you could certainly go to the Cure Violence website, but there are also Prevention Institute and NNH VIP have a lot of resources on their pages as well. And it's really about the health community taking this on, about changing the way we look at it. It's not about bad people, it's not about punishment, but it's about contagious behavior. And that really changes the whole conversation. Because we could start to talk about this, about exposure, about transmission, about social pressure. And when we start to do that, the ways in which we address it change. And I think that's an important change that needs to happen in order for communities to be able to put violence into the past. If you have any questions, please feel free to email me. And thank you very much.